Hello and welcome to Whence Came You, a Freemasonic podcast featuring research papers and discussions related to Freemasonry. I'm your host, Robert Johnson, a York Rite Mason and Knight Templar. Well, I hope everything is doing well this week. By the time this episode has been released, I will have done a couple of degrees in the Royal Arch this past Saturday. And I guess to start things off, I found a cool post on the 1 Minute Mason you might find interesting. Thursday, March 22nd, 2012. Memphis, Tennessee, founded in 1819, was named after Egypt's ancient Nile River capital. The town was originally to have been named Jackson, in honor of the most worshipful brother, Andrew Jackson. Brother Jackson, however, declined to have the town so named. He got his due when Alexandria, a settlement on the forked Deer River in central western Tennessee, was named for him 3 years later. The town so honored Jackson primarily because of his success as a general, 7 years before he became president of the United States. Next, I have a piece published a few years ago, yet I found it to be very cool, so here's that for you now. It's a news from Sunday, 26th of October in 2008. Maltese Freemasons Go Public on the Internet by Matthew Vella. After years of notoriety as a secret society and a raging debate over the alleged membership of public officials, Malta's Freemasons have gone public with a fully-fledged website describing their activities, history, and also their statue. Malta's Freemasons now welcome the public to go beyond its portrayal as a secret, self-serving, or sinister society to one whose motivation centers on humanity, tolerance, and charity. Malta's lodges from the English, Scottish, and Irish constitutions congregated in a once single Grand Lodge in 2004 when the Leinster, Abercorn, and Fenichie lodges of the Irish constitution resolved to create a Maltese Grand Lodge with Brother Joseph P. Cordina as its most worshipful Grand Master. And with that comes a more transparent approach to their activities after years of attracting some of the most sensationalist of coverage. We abide by the laws of the state and are critical of those in violation and expect similar from those around us. We recognize there are some who regard our titling to officers, our terminology, our formal dress codes, and our conduct as rather quaint in modern society. But we are unapologetic in adhering to our traditions, the Grand Master writes in his welcoming statement. Freemasonry was largely viewed with suspicion in Malta, mainly due to the influence of the Roman Catholic Church and its antipathy toward Masonic lodges. The acrimonious relationship was best characterized when Lord Gerald Strickland, the leader of the Constitutional Party, was said to have been seen wearing the Freemason's garb in an affidavit signed by Ettore Bono, who was working as a waiter during the Freemason's activity in Valletta. The pre-electoral effect of Torino, as Bono was nicknamed, was devastating for Strickland. Then in 1990, news that the magistrate Carol Peralta had been the worshipful master of Leinster Lodge before being appointed magistrate fueled speculation about impartiality of public officers. A decade later, the bribery allegations against former magistrate Patrick Vella and former Chief Justice Noel Arrigo rekindled the debate on the alleged close links between the judiciary and Freemasonry when TVM, a program Bande Plus, aired secret footage of Maltese Freemasons gathered in ritual. That turbulent period does not go unnoticed in the Sovereign Grand Lodge's history in the website. The autumn of 2002 was to provide an unlikely catalyst for changes in matters Masonic on Malta. The national television channel aired a sensationalist exposé program based on secretly filmed Masonic Lodge proceedings by a brother, with reference to the secret footage filmed by the privileged investigator Joe Zahara, a former Freemason who at the time worked for the Bande Plus team. The Freemasons say the program served to embarrass Maltese Masons living and working in the dominantly Catholic environment known to disfavor Freemasonry. An understandable furor over disciplinary action ensued, and there can be no doubt that the wavering opinions as to the potential creation of an independent Maltese Grand Lodge were swayed in favor at this time. Since that time, however, Maltese Freemasonry does not seem to have dwindled, with three subordinate lodges, the Hospitallers Lodge, the Ars Descendi Lodge, and the Loggia Flos Mundi, being constituted in recent years. The Grand Lodge's main quarters is Castelviani in Valletta, which houses the Lodge of St. John and St. Paul, founded in 1850 by Walter Rodwell Wright, Chief Justice of Malta from 1814 to 1826. This week's famous Freemason is also the paper. January 27th, 1756 to December 5th, 1791. Brother Mozart, the youngest child and only surviving son of a Freemason, Leopold Mozart Jonas Wolfgangus Theophilus, was born in Salzburg in 1756. He showed early interest, both as a keyboard player and violinist, and soon turned his hand to composition. Mozart composed a number of Masonic pieces. When his father received his Masonic second degree, Wolfgang wrote Fellowcraft's Journey, OPK 468, to honor the occasion. For Lodge Zur Waltaticate, he wrote Opening Ode, OPK 483, and Closing Ode, OPK 484. His last Masonic work, OPK 623, was written for the dedication of a Masonic temple in Vienna on November 15th, 1791. Mozart was essentially an operatic composer. His last stage work, The Magic Flute, an opera with strong hermetic themes, was running with success at the time of his death. He was initiated December 14th, 1784, passed January 7th, 1785, and raised sometime before April 22nd, 1785. The Magic Flute, Newcomb Condi, 33rd degree Mason, wrote this piece. Wolfgang Amadeus Mozart was 28 years of age when, in the autumn of 1784, he joined a Masonic lodge. As a pianist, little Wolfgang had been an infant prodigy, exhibited by his father throughout Europe. But he was now a recognized and admired composer living in Vienna. The very year of his initiation, his first great opera, The Marriage of Figaro, had been produced in Paris. This was, however, before the days of copyright law and the earnings of a genius were meager. During the 18th century, Freemasonry in Vienna had a political as well as a benevolent side. It counted as its members many highly placed politicians and ecclesiastics whose ideal was the regeneration of humanity by moral means. It was hated by the Catholic Church and certain despotic political authorities who deemed it dangerous both to religion and the well-being of the state. The Church, however, even as today in as certain Latin countries, did not consider it expedient to challenge high-placed persons, nominally its members, but also of the fraternity. The Empress Maria Theresa had been one who was opposed to Masonry, and in 1743 had ordered Viennese Lodge raided, forcing its master and her husband Francis I to make his escape by a secret staircase. The Emperor Joseph II, from 1780 to 1790, was favorably inclined to the fraternity, although the clergy did their best to get the lodges suppressed. Such was a Masonic milieu when Wolfgang Mozart became Master Mason. He must have been greatly moved and inspired by his experience. Almost immediately, he composed his Freemason's funeral music and his music for the opening and closing of a lodge. He now composed his opera, Don Giovanni, and his three great symphonies, the E-flat, the G minor, and the C major, as well as the great number of concertos and chamber music works. His last great opera, The Magic Flute, opened in Vienna on the evening of September 30th, 1791. Mozart conducted the first two performances when he was overtaken by his last illness. He lingered on for a while. The opera had an unprecedented run for more than 100 consecutive performances. It is said that in his sickbed, watch in hand, he would follow in imagination the performance of the Magic Flute in the theater. Then he died after its 67th performance. The Magic Flute makes no mention of Freemasonry as such, but it always has been accepted as Masonic opera. Musicians assert that even the music has much craft significance, beginning in the overture with its three solemn chords in the brass. In keeping with the fashion of the time, the plot is half-serious, half-comic, a fantasy of magic and mystery laid in a neverland called Egypt. It depicts the ancient mysteries and presents much craft symbolism. To the Viennese of that day, the queen of the night was clearly the unfriendly Empress Maria Theresa. The good Sarasto was Ignaz von Born, an eminent scientist and Masonic leader, the hero, Tamino, was the good Emperor Joseph, and the heroine, Pamina, the Austrian people themselves. The first program credited the libretto to the actor-producer Schikaneder, but it is now thought that it was written by Giesek, the friend and intimate of Goethe and Schiller, who probably desired to remain anonymous for political reasons. The opera has remained popular through the years and is included in the present repertoire of the Metropolitan Opera Company. Next, I have a piece from the December-January issue of California Freemason from the year 2011, and it's entitled Marks of Mankind. It was early 2010 during the frigid winter of southern France. Scattered amidst the usual cave drawings of horses and other animal shapes, scientists noticed something new, something that had gone undetected until then, a written language 30,000 years old. The researchers from Canada's University of Victoria made the discovery while compiling the cave signs of nearly 150 sites across Ice Age France. This included Chauvet Cave, which contained mankind's earliest known cave drawings rendered in 30,000 BCE. They found 26 strikingly similar signs composed of lines, circles, and triangles scraped into the rock walls of many of the caves. All signs point to one thing. During the last Ice Age, as the first African civilizations were just arriving in Europe, prehistoric humans were already using a system of symbols to communicate. These are the first glimmerings of abstract behavior of people representing a concept that you can't just draw, explained researcher Jean-Vieux von Petzinger in an interview with New Scientist magazine. Not only that, but it means that we have a bunch of people who agreed on what these symbols meant. In the 30 million millennia since, mankind has continued to use symbols to communicate, from stop signs to smartphone apps. Symbols are an instant prompt for shared knowledge and experience. Modern corporations spend millions conceiving and reconceiving their logos for just right brand identity. Pepsi Company spent several hundreds of millions of dollars for their re-envisioned logo in 2008. And from prehistoric times to today, cultures around the world have folded symbols into their societies and lessons, religious guides, and touchstones of their identity. 1,000-year-old barcodes. From sport logos to the flags of nations, symbols are widely used to communicate identity. Whether a mark of belonging or an assertion of individuality, that's been the case for a long time. According to Joan Fletcher, archaeology research fellow at University of York in Britain, ancient Greek and Romans used symbolic tattoos to mark someone as an individual belonging to a religious sect or a slave to an owner. Polynesian tribal tattoos originated for the opposite purpose, to differentiate. The practice began about 1,000 years ago with the indigenous Maori culture of New Zealand. The face was embellished by incredibly elaborate tattoos, or moko, which were regarded as marks of high status. Fletcher explains in September of 2007 interview with the Smithsonian magazine. No two designs were alike, and they symbolized specific information about the individual's status, rank, ancestry, and even abilities. It has accurately been described as a form of ID card or passport, Fletcher says, a kind of aesthetic barcode for the face. They weren't the only ones. In Native North America, the tribes belonging to the Iroquois Federation identified themselves by tattooing clan and family symbols. They conveyed individual triumphs, too. Crosshatches on the face of an Iroquois man related to success in battles, and small marks on the thighs kept track of how many enemies they had killed. In fact, all along the East Coast, from Florida to the St. Lawrence River, Native Americans practiced body art and tattooing. The symbols identified them to outsiders and solidified the bonds of society within. For centuries of Masons, the white lambskin apron, the square and compass, and countless other Masonic symbols have also symbolized belonging and fellowship that is difficult to put into words. Brother, I've been there. In some cultures, symbols convey a shared faith or ancestry. Among others, they have come to represent a shared experience. From the earliest Polynesian seafarers to today's modern sailors, tattoos have been used to record a sailor's travels around the globe, a travel log that fellow sailors can decode. Modern-day athletes brand themselves with a special tattoo after completing the grueling Ironman triathlon. Among many Native American tribes, fry bread, a basic fried dough, has evolved into a relevant symbol. The food originated during the Long Walk, a 300-mile journey at gunpoint from tribal land in Arizona to an internment camp in New Mexico. As a result, fry bread symbolizes a shared experience of adversity and survival, and plays a unifying role in intertribal powwows. Of course, masonry symbols represent shared experience too. The working tools and white apron connect members with the livelihood of the first operative stonemasons. Every member's memory of the degree rituals is infused with these same symbols. So, while it's not a voyage across the seven seas, Masonic symbols also represent a shared journey. These things are hard to put into words, and the experience inevitably varies from person to person. A symbol can be a more inclusive and accurate way to refer to an abstract experience. It's another thing we have in common with our Ice Age ancestors. While von Petzinger admits that the cave signs found in southern France aren't all that interesting visually, she points out the power of their simplicity. They're transmitting information about abstract things we can't see in the real world. Mind the culture gap. How we perceive a symbol depends on what we associate with it, which comes from our surrounding culture. It's why the golden arches of McDonald's and the mouse ears of Walt Disney might elicit shrieks of joy from American children, but no recognition whatsoever among Aboriginal tribes of the Australian outback. So while symbols can represent an entire system of beliefs, the key is to take it in context. The swastika is one example. Recognized by many as a symbol of the Nazi Party, it connotes terror and racism for many people today. However, it originated as a symbol of peace and protection and still represents these things in other cultures. As one of humanity's oldest symbols, the swastika is found in Hindu holy texts, in ancient Buddhist and Mayan temples, and in Native American pottery, rugs, and other artifacts. Historians say it has symbolized the sun and its rotation, and the four directions, the concept of rebirth, abundance, and spiritual victory. It remains a prominent symbol of peace in Hinduism, Jainism, and Buddhism, and it adorns temples, shrines, and clothes throughout Asia. The Trinity Knot, also called the Triquetra, is found in ancient Celtic texts. In that tradition, it symbolizes strength and unity. The knot itself has no beginning or end. According to Celtic lore, it represents the stages of a woman's life, young woman, mother, and grandmother. But in Christianity, it is a common symbol of the Holy Trinity representing the Father, Son, and the Holy Spirit. In both cultures, the Trinity knot is cultural touchstone, a reminder of important spiritual beliefs. The same can be said of the Siva Linga, a short cylindrical pillar worshipped throughout the Hindu world as a symbol of the god Shiva. In ancient Egypt, one such symbol was the Ankh, a hieroglyphic character meaning life. These symbols, which are simple, are used as daily reminders of shared faith. Friend or foe, some 30,000 years ago, symbols were painted in caves as means of communicating when words didn't exist. But long after, symbols were used as a way to communicate when words didn't suffice or weren't safe. The Ichthys, a simple symbol of two intersecting arcs, traces back to the Roman Empire's persecution of Christians in the first few centuries. During this time, according to Christian history, Christians used the fish symbol to distinguish friends from foes, to adorn gravestones, and to mark locations that were safe for believers, including secret gathering places, homes, and businesses. On the website of Christianity Today International, the editor writes, "According to one ancient story, when a Christian met a stranger on the road, the Christian sometimes drew one arc of the simple fish outline in the dirt. If the stranger drew the other arc, both believers knew they were in good company. Instead of drawing an arc in the dirt, a mason might say, 'I see you have traveled some,' use a secret grip, or test another man on his knowledge of ritual. Anywhere he goes in the world, he can use these symbols to find others who share his values." Life's little directional signs. Some symbols do more than give clues to individuals' identity, life experience, or ideology. Rather, they are spiritual guideposts used as tools for a better life. The Om is the most important symbol in Hinduism, occurring in every prayer and enshrined in every temple and family shrine. It represents an incomprehensible idea, the absolute, or the source of all existence. It's a vision icon, but it's also sacred sound. Aspiring yogis and those seeking inner peace use all aspects of the symbol, picturing the icon, focusing on the feeling and sound of speaking it, and meditating on the concept it represents. On a path to enlightenment, Om is more than a symbol. It's a way of life. Masonry symbols become a way of life for members too. They are daily reminders of Masonic values, a workbook for morality. These symbols are meant to be contemplated, defined by the individual, and acted upon. Symbols are a way of teaching in a simple and a straightforward way, says Brother Brent Morris, managing editor of the Scottish Rite Journal. But they can have hidden meaning, and when you study them, you find more layers. Of course, Many of the symbols hail from architecture, as the speculative Freemasons in the 1600s found the construction of cathedrals an apt metaphor for the construction of a character. But ask a dozen Masons what the trowel or winding staircase represents, and you might get a dozen different answers. That's because Masonic symbols, though discussed broadly in lectures and rituals, have deeper meanings that vary from one Mason to the next. "We don't try to answer all the questions," says John L. Cooper III, past Grand Secretary of California. "We don't say that this is the meaning of the symbol. Now memorize it and move on." Freemasonry instead encourages members to think for themselves, reflect on these symbols, and see if they can apply them in life. And just as a Mason's need to change over time, so can his interpretation of Masonic symbols. "That's what makes Masonry timeless," says R. Stephen Doan, past Grand Master of California. "Symbolism opens up your mind to think in a new way and puts you on the pathway of discovery. It's a tall order for some simple icons, but since the first marks were scratched on prehistoric cave walls, mankind has used symbols to represent ideas that are too big for words. Those ideas and those symbols that contain them still shape our world today." That's it for this week. Remember to find us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at WhenceCameU, and add us to your circle on Google Plus at the email address wcypodcast@gmail.com. Email the show at that same address. Visit the website for tons of cool stuff, including links to the Android and Apple WhenceCameU podcast apps, which allow you to listen to the streaming rather than syncing. As always, keep yourselves circumscribed, and for WhenceCameU, I'm Robert Johnson.